D-Day, 75 years ago, 6th of the 6th, 1944, and its implications for today. For both the Reformation Society and Frontline Fellowship, we've been 38 years in the front line, ministering behind enemy lines for Christ. D-Day is the largest amphibious invasion in history. And today, the 6th of the 6th, 2019, is the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And world leaders from President Trump to the Queen of England and a whole lot of others are gathered on the beaches of Normandy this day in northern France. Major military, air, navy, army commemoration, for some people still very personal. And this year, they believe there's only 36 D-Day veterans that will be able to make it to this. And one 97-year-old parabat made a jump second time. And 97, of course, in tandem with a younger, fitter person, but still significant. This is something to honor brave men who did an extraordinary accomplishment. And if you go there today, this is kind of what Normandy beaches look like. And yep, there are a few tanks who just were offloaded a bit short. And today, you may not be able to imagine what was going on around here. But there are some concrete reminders of the Atlantic Wall. And you can still find remnants of the defenses, and even you can see shrapnel marks, and amazingly there are still some remnants of the obstacles, the blockages. And this is just showing you some of the craters 75 years later. You can still see how, and I've walked in these craters in Ypres in Belgium, it's still there. You know, it's recreated the topography of these areas. This is Ponte de Hoc, where the Rangers climbed up to disable these guns. Phenomenal achievement. When they got to the top after losing a third of their men, they found there were no guns there. They built the concrete pillboxes, but they didn't have enough. So they felt a little deflated too. Do all that effort and finally get there to find there were no guns to threaten invasion fleets anyway. You can only imagine if walls could speak. Some have been kept as a form of a memorial that people can imagine something of what it was like. So the invasion force was the Americans on the far left. They got Utah and Omaha Beach, and the British were the far right. They got Sword Beach. The Canadians were given Juneau, and the British got gold in the middle. Generally speaking, the British and Canadians had it pretty easy. The Americans got the worst of it, especially at Omaha Beach, mainly because all of the artillery barrage failed to reach its target. So the largest air, sea, and land invasion in history. 6,330 ships. Now think of the Spanish Armada, 120 ships. Here we're talking about 6,330 ships, of which 3,500 were troop carriers, 120 were warships, 1,260 were merchant vessels, 250 were minesweepers, 600 specialist craft. Specialist craft, these were ships that could go pretty close to shore, drop down a what do you call it, when you drop down the ramp, and trucks and tanks and all that could fly through there, drive through. 500 cargo carriers, 100 destroyers and frigates, and of course, amongst all that, you've got to think of I presume the specialist crafts have got to also include landing craft. Where are the landing craft otherwise? You've also got 10,440 aircraft, which included 4,450 bombers, 1,370 air transport. When you say air transport, you're talking about what the Americans called the C-47 Skytrain, or what we called the DC-3 Dakota. Same thing. And the glider, 670 gliders. Now, the interesting thing is this is a British special. Most British airborne were delivered by gliders because it took less time to train an airborne soldier who just gets delivered by glider than to teach him to parachute. All the American airborne, if I'm not mistaken, were dropped by parachute, but the British, most of the airborne arrived by glider. And, of course, 3,950 fighters. That's a phenomenal air armada. Then you go down to the troops for landing. There was 153,000 invasion troops, but actually only 129,710 landed that day because of complications. Not everything got done the way it was meant to. 12,500 vehicles, which got delivered to the beach. We're talking about on that day, 6th and 6th. 1,550 tanks, 23,400 airborne troops. Biggest airborne assault in the history of the world to that date. But before the end of the year, they increased it at Arnhem and Eindhoven, the British 1st Airborne and the American 82nd and 101st Airborne landed 32,000 airborne troops by parachute or glider in the Netherlands. So staggering. Before this time, the biggest airborne assault in history had been Crete, which the Germans took at great loss, but they succeeded. So that's by the numbers. The posters, propaganda, mobilizing people ahead of time included farm scrap builds, tanks and guns, 18 tons of scrap metal goes into a medium tank. Women of Britain come into the factories. And in fact, most of the weapons of war, bombs and everything else, were made by women in the factories. The men were mostly conscripted. And so in the factories, you'd see the women handling these bombs and even making the aircraft and whatever else was involved. And so war bonds, they wanted people to buy war bonds to enable them, that you'd get your money back, maybe, if we win. But the basic idea is getting people to buy war bonds. They'll get some increase later, maybe, probably on the basis of whatever we can loot on the other side. This is the year. It's up to us to let them have it. And so, of course, there's all these weapons, all those planes, all the ships and special ships. Okay, you can see the normal landing craft there, and then you see these specialized vessels that could actually take tanks and deliver them. And attack, buy war bonds. So this was not exactly a surprise. Everyone knew for years this attack was coming. Only question was where. Canada even came out with some pretty amazing artwork from the 1940s, imagining the motorbike soldiers being like the knights and the cavalry of old. I think I kind of felt like that sometimes when I was on a motorbike, sort of thinking, you know, we sort of like the knights of today. This is a French poster at the beginning of the war with Germany, pointing out, look how small Germany is. Look how huge we are. The French and the British Empire together, we're unbeatable, you know. I think it took the Germans a whole 6 weeks to beat the French Empire. And that's because Rommel stopped for a pause to take photographs on the way, but otherwise it would have done quicker. Interesting, because so often the Second World War is portrayed as Germany being the big bully and poor Britain all alone and France. But they had the first and the second greatest empires in the world. And combined, all this you can see is French and British. So look at this poster. United. The United Nations Fight for Freedom. I don't know how many people know the United Nations actually started in 1943, and the United Nations was, well, the first General Secretary was a communist KGB agent, and he organized it under FDR's instructions in California, in San Francisco, actually. But notice, okay, the American flag is the highest, but the Soviet flag is sort of pretty much front and center. They fight for freedom. I think that's got to be a surprise for any poor soul who suffered under the Soviet Union, that the Soviet Union was fighting for freedom. I can't see the South African flag in this one. Wait a minute, there it is. Yeah. There's the South African flag. We sort of tucked away there. It's a bit more obvious what they stand for when you get to this one. This is a playing card that they would be handing out to the soldiers. My dad even got one of these. This man is your friend, Russian. See? Star, hammer and sickle. He fights for freedom. Would you have believed it? Here you can see, again, united we are strong, united we will win. Not only includes the Soviet Union, nationalist China, which they're about to betray, even Chile's there, Norway, Belgium tucked away there, Mexico, yeah. And so massive amounts of weaponry were being assembled. The colossal armada, tens of thousands of bombers, 60,000 Sherman tanks. I think they made 120,000 before the end of the year. The logistics. Just between January and June 1944, British factories produced 7 million jerry cans in preparation for the invasion. And they designed specialist ships that had never been in existence before. And by the way, when I was just seeing a documentary on the D-Day landings, where they're talking about all these specialist weapons that had to be designed to get these tanks and weaponry across the seas, and saying this could never have succeeded without inventing the landing craft and these specialized landing vessels. Which is what Pat Buchanan points out in his book, The Unnecessary War, saying Germany never built a landing craft, never built an aircraft carrier, never built an aircraft that could take off or land on an aircraft carrier. But there's no landing craft ever made. And if you sort of think, well, what about Operation Sea Lion? Because people like my father, who spent all 6 years in Second World War as a bombardier in the 8th Army, he said, we were told we had to fight because Germany wanted to invade Britain. But in fact, the evidence is, like David Irving's book, Hitler's War and so on, there never was any serious plan to invade Britain. It was a propaganda ruse on both sides. In order to try and persuade Britain to make peace, they spoke about, you know, we might consider invading, but there never was a serious OKW investigation into it, because they never even built a landing craft. So what's this world domination and trying to invade Britain if you haven't even built a landing craft? Britain knows they couldn't have got to France without landing craft. I mean, how are you going to land your troops? Can't go into the harbour and go through customs. So the British, of course, had the most incredible navy the world had ever seen, but 6,000 vessels, 120 warships, 100 destroyers and frigates, just colossal amount of weaponry, 10,000 aircraft. In the first newspaper reports, they're talking about 4,000 ships, 1,000 thousands of smaller vessels, and they're speaking about 11,000 first-line airplanes. So, in fact, I've seen some stats of that the airplanes were well over 11,000. Shelled by 640 guns. D-Day landings in Brittany is revealed. By the way, you know why it's called Brittany? Brittany, because at one time Britain owned that part of France. Normandy, because that's where the Normans who invaded England in 1066 came from. It's funny, the Normans invaded England in 1066, and 1944 the Brits invaded Normandy. Normans comes from Norsemen. At one time the Vikings took it, and Rollo made it his personal sort of kingdom, so to speak, nominally under the King of France. And so you wonder about these bags. Okay, they've got their parachute there, they've got their reserve chute, which is a little chute there, and then the kit. And so basically, as you jump out, your kit drops, and the idea is it's dangling and it's got to hit the ground first. You don't want your kit on you. In fact, the weight's just too much. That's a lot of kit these guys are to carry, but they need to carry everything they needed, because they had to survive and own for quite a while. And that's a lot of kit. Now, this is his reserve chute in front. He should have his main kit dangling from him. Where is that here? Missing in this picture, but he would have needed his kit. And of course, if you happen to carry the bazooka and so on, yeah, that's all extra. The Navy, with 15, 14, and 16-inch guns, was just plastering the beaches. And apparently, the British Navy did an extremely good job and flattened everything. The American Navy seems to have completely missed all the defenses of Omaha Beach. So when the Americans land at Omaha Beach, basically the German defense were completely undisturbed and they just wreaked havoc amongst them. Notice the detail in some of these pictures, like many of the men having plastic over their barrels, the idea that, you know, don't want to get water down the barrel, less cleaning, less fighting rust and so on. So they had some kind of ideas, and just the attention to detail many people had. And quite a few had patched. Like these, looks like he's got something strapped to the back of his helmet. Quite a few pictures indicate that many of them had bandages and other kind of first aid things strapped to the back of their helmets probably easy access and so on. You can just imagine landing on these beaches. You see this, they call this a Rommel asparagus. It would be a pole which at high tide, if you brought your vessel over, it would ignite an explosion. But that's why they had to attack at low tide. Here again, you see the United Nations fight for freedom. And we might be at the bottom, but South Africa's flag is on there. We were part of the United Nations fighting for freedom, along with the Soviet Union. I don't know what freedom they were fighting for. Freedom shall prevail. Notice the Red Army soldier here, and that looks like a Chinese soldier there. And you've got interesting groups. I would guess that could be the Kenyan African Rifles back there, maybe even the Rhodesian African Rifles for that matter, Indian. And perhaps this is one of the South Africans. That would be Aussie, yeah. So maybe South Africans indicate by that kind of hat. So on the other side, they had their propaganda too. So this would have been the German propaganda, provide the weapons for the front. The link between the worker in the factory and the soldier on the front line. And again, you've got the eagle, you've got the old church there, and also German war propaganda. Behind the enemy is the Jew. And behind the screen, and the screen is to symbolize the Hollywood screen, you get the Jew. Sort of reminds you of Harvey Weinstein of today. I'm sure they've always had those sort of people at Hollywood. And again, behind the communist flag, you get destruction. And Bolshevism is the threat to the whole world. And notice the hammer and sickle in the six-pointed hexagram. Victory or Bolshevism? So they were infantry, queen of the armed forces. And I remember being told that when I got into infantry. Not that you sort of feel like it, you feel like the infantry gets to walk the whole way and get bombarded while they're about it. Again, you've got heroic pictures going forward and say, we will do the fighting. Your work provides the victory. Again, speaking to the factory worker, you've got to provide the grenades and all these sort of things. And the three main armed forces, army, Navy, Air Force, working together. So that's the propaganda from both sides. The Atlantic Wall stretched from the Arctic Sea all across the coast of Norway and Denmark and Germany and Netherlands and Belgium, France, all the way to the Spanish border. The Atlantic Wall was a colossal, several thousand kilometers, something like 3,000 kilometer defense position. Of course, there wasn't a wall the whole way along. The term Atlantic Wall, something of a propaganda piece, and Erwin Rommel was the one chosen to defend the Atlantic Wall in the French sector. Here of the victory in the West. Here you can see at the beginning of the war, 1940, you've got the German forces seriously outnumbered by the French and British forces. The Allies outnumbered them in terms of tanks and in terms of everything. They had more tanks, thicker armor, bigger armaments on their tanks. The idea of the Germans outnumbering the Allies in the 1940 battle for France is false. And the idea of the Germans having wonder weapons also false. They didn't have the Tiger tank. Their Mark I, Mark II, and Mark III were inferior in almost everything from armor through to the amount of armaments on them and the calibers to the Allies. It was just that they used their weapons better and they had better commanders that they managed to win phenomenal victory very fast against superior numbers in every case. And you just need to read what Rommel did in the 7th Panzer Division, what he achieved while being wounded multiple times, having his tank destroyed in the middle of battle, getting out, continuing the battle, full of blood. And Erwin Rommel advanced 140 kilometers in one day in battle. Unheard of. Unprecedented. You never had anything like it before. He's still getting his book of records, as far as I know, for that. His 7th Panzer Division got to the coast the fastest, and they faced some of the biggest battles, and they were the first to break through the actual Maginot Line, which is the most intensive fortifications ever designed by man. And they also faced close to Arras, the biggest counteroffensive of the whole time from the Allies. And he managed, without a tank nearby, only with some armored anti-tank weapons, he managed to destroy the entire French and British armored attack on their position, hold the line. And for this reason, he got the Knight's Cross of the Iron Cross. Paratrooping was actually pioneered by the German army in the, or should I say German Air Force. Paratroopers were part of the German Air Force. And they using these old Junker 86s, were they? Those are the three engine ones, which was the first plane in the South African Airways, by the way. First one to do Cape Town to London and all that sort of thing. And notice the way that the Germans dived out of planes. Their pioneer parachuters dived head first. We go feet first. They also had their parachutes attached to a single point on a belt at the back, whereas ours is more spread. Of course, they were the pioneers, discovered quickly not the best way of doing things, but hey, somebody's got to start. I mean, look at the way some of these guys are coming diving out. It's pretty nerve-wracking, but they took Holland, crossed the Meuse River, did all the getting through. These are some of the obstacles at the Maginot Line, which is meant to be impervious to armor. And the French army broke all records in surrendering. And here, Erwin Rommel, in his first blitz across France, he got to the Channel coast first, and he managed to capture his one little panzer division, managed to capture something like 140,000 Allied troops, including many thousands of British, hundreds of tanks, thousands of machine guns, hundreds of artillery pieces. Again, I don't think there's ever been a faster, more effective victory. When the Americans now speak about shock and awe, shock and awe is just an American term for blitzkrieg. The Germans pioneered blitzkrieg, and today everyone's trying to copy it. And I don't know if you've heard why they have trees planted both sides of the Champs-Élysées in Paris. It's so that the German army can march in the shade. And here they are going down the Champs-Élysées. And the French, who thought they were the world superpower, things have changed since Napoleon. Marshal Pétain, who had fought against the Germans in the First World War, became their ally now. He took over the control of France, of Vichy France. And Adolf Hitler, when it was suggested that he should make Marshal Pétain wait outside in the cold and the rain, as the French had required the Germans in 1918 for the 11th of November signing of the armistice, he said, no, we need to be better than that. And in fact, he released almost all their soldiers from capture, and they were not kept in prison camps through the war and things like that. Interesting that Adolf Hitler then spent a couple of days touring Paris, especially going through the art sections, and he was very much into the architecture. That's why he's got Albert Speer with him. Albert Speer's the architect of Germany, who Adolf Hitler's main ambition in life had been to be an architect. And he spent an inordinate amount of time during the war designing new buildings and great monuments and magnificent theatres and things like this. And Albert Speer got 20 years imprisonment for being the architect of Hitler. Erwin Rommel, this is the propaganda pictures the Germans put out of the Atlantic War. Of course, they didn't have many of these, and those that they had were actually at Calais, which is right closest to Britain. So it's where there's only about 20 miles between Great Britain and France. At Calais, they put most of this impressive, and of course, you know, this is a totally posed picture. So the British and almost everyone expected, or the Germans mostly expect the British and Americans to attack between Dover and Calais, closest place where we've now got the channel, the under channel tunnel. And because it's the closest, most logistic, I mean, to get across this channel is quite a problem. And so it was expected. So that's where most of the defenses were. Although it was further to go to the Normandy beaches, it was strategically wiser because the vast concentration of German defenses was up in this region, which is what you'd expect. There was also a colossal amount of deception operation involved in this. The biggest web of deception was set in convincing the Germans through double and treble agents that the attack was coming at Calais. And there was really elaborate, you might have even come across things like the Man Who Never Was and so on, where they released from a torpedo tube a dead body which had chained to his wrist the briefcase with the plans of the Normandy invasion and things like this. And cinema tickets, girlfriend pictures. This is just somebody who had died, and they built up an elaborate story in his pockets. And of course, he had the key for the briefcase locked there in his pocket, conveniently, and all this sort of thing. But it was more than that. Every single German agent sent into Britain in the Second World War was intercepted and given a choice. We're going to hang you as a spy, or you can be a double agent, work for us. And you better make it believable or you will be hung. And every single Abwehr agent in Britain was working for the British MI6 turned operatives, and they were all feeding completely believable misinformation. So there was a tremendous web of deceit. And we know a lot of this because after 60 years of sealing, all the GCHQ files have been released. And I read through The Secret War last year, The Secret War by Max Hastings, which is a colossal view of the Second World War entirely from the point of view of the espionage agencies of Britain, France, Germany, Japan, America, and all the rest. Absolutely staggering. And as one general who did the foreword for the book says, this book requires every single book documentary Second World War to be rewritten, because so much of what we've been fed was propaganda, and now we know what actually was going on behind the scenes. Bluntly, it comes out with the British had deception operations everywhere. They broke the codes. The Americans had broken the Japanese codes back in the 1920s, which is why they invented fax machines, so that they could get Japanese script across to the American mainland, where they could decipher, because they already had the code, which was what they called magic. And then the British had the German Enigma codes broken before the war. They knew everything they were doing, when they were going to do it, ahead of time, and all of that sort of thing. It was very, very advanced, a form of interception of all instructions given to commanders. And so this gives you a bit of a feel for the spread of the war. The situation, wide-ranging, how Germany had France and Britain mobilizing against them, and of course, blockade, naval blockade. How the British were then trying to take Norway to prevent Germany getting all its iron ore from Sweden. Narvik was the key goal, and Winston Churchill basically spilled the beans with inadvertent comments, which was lifted and brought back to Germany through neutral agencies such as Sweden, that they were planning an invasion of Norway to starve Germany of the iron ore that they needed for their weaponry. They wouldn't be able to win without it. And so the Germans beat the British to their invasion, in some cases by hours. And in the case of Narvik, not at all, because the British managed to take Narvik, and that was a huge battle all over the place there. And then all the battles on this side. And of course, it got more and more complicated. You will often hear that the Soviet Union was shocked and all this at Germany invading them. In fact, nothing of the sort. There was no secret about it. Again, the secret war makes it clear. The Russians knew for months ahead it was coming. In fact, the Russians were planning to invade Germany from the rear. They'd been on a colossal build-up since the 1930s. They were planning invasion. They just wanted to first sit out until Germany and France had bludgeoned one another, and then they'd attack from the rear. And they were shocked that Germany could have beaten France, the world superpower, in just 6 weeks. And so they went on an even more accelerated basis. And although there was a non-aggression pact between them, Hitler knew that Stalin had no intention of keeping it. He was planning invasion. In fact, the entire Russian force of over 5 million were concentrated on the border, and they were pushing everything. Stalin was making speeches to his officers about the coming war with Germany. And when he was warned about Barbarossa, because Germany was riddled with double agents, not only British, but also Soviet. There was a lot of communists in Germany undermining the war from within. He just said, let them come. We're ready for them. And we've got so much documentation that's out there on it in A Secret War, and also Hitler's War by David Irving, documenting how there was no surprise about Barbarossa. Some people said Barbarossa was a tremendous mistake, because what was the point of invading Russia? It was too big. But yet there was no choice, because Russia was about to invade them. And Barbarossa was unleashed just as the Soviet army was preparing, and so they got them in the forward areas, and they were able to destroy most of the Air Force fast, and so on. Again, to give you a feel, so often you get the idea of this big bully Germany bullying these poor little countries like Britain and France and America and Russia. Here's Germany. There's Finland. There's Romania, Hungary, and Bulgaria, who were allied with Germany. And there's Libya and Italy. That is the entire Axis powers. Oh, Japan. There we go. So the rest are on the side of the French, the Russians, the allies, and so on. So when you look at it from this perspective, it's quite clear who was encircling who. Here again, the German forces and the allies, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and Italy, that's the Axis powers, Japan. The rest are against them. And here again, you can see just the way how it all worked out. And the Italians had quite a bit of extra forces as well. They had Libya, and they had Abyssinia and Somalia. And by the way, it was South African Springbok Legion that liberated Abyssinia, what today's Ethiopia, from the Italians. This gives you the idea of the far-rangingness of the war and how far the German forces went into the Soviet Union and the battles. And people often forget that Vichy France was actually independent of Germany for the first part of the war. And again, you get a bit of a feel for the major battles and the extent of this force. Now, for some reason, Germany was allied to Italy, which was not actually a help. It was a hindrance, because everything Mussolini did only drained away German forces, and he created chaos by invading Greece, for example, started all kinds of problems. When he tried to invade Egypt, and the British, my dad was part of all that, were capturing hundreds of thousands of Italians in single battles, whole divisions, dozens of generals being captured by the British. And the British, for something like, 100 men lost on their side, would be inflicting thousands of casualties and capturing 140,000 Italians in a single battle. It was seriously embarrassing. So Germany had to do something to pull the chestnuts out the fire, as they've said. So the Italians had this big Roman Empire, which looked very good on posters. And this looks quite impressive. I don't know that I'd want to drive in those sort of tanks. You've probably seen these at the War Museum. And this looks like tremendous aggressive force. If only our armies could be like the propaganda. And here you've got the British surrendering to a few Italians with small arms, giving up their armored cars, which I'm sure could have happened in their dreams. But in fact, the British forces in North Africa, called the Desert Army, were not just British forces. It was Rhodesians, South Africans, and they fought hard. 6th South African Infantry was up there, and they had their Bren carriers, they had their Matildas and Crusader tanks, and they very quickly advanced into Italian-controlled Libya and rounded up colossal amounts of Italian prisons. It was actually embarrassing. And my father said that when they would see a plane in the sky, or they'd look to check, is it Italian, they wouldn't bother going for cover. If it was German, they'd die for cover. He said, later in the war, when the Americans came in, if it was American, you'd die for cover. He said, they called the American Air Force, the American Luftwaffe, said they believe in bombing everybody. And collateral damage was their special stock and trade. So they were bombed probably as much by the American Air Force as they were by the Luftwaffe. But still, the Italians had an embarrassing series of terrible defeats in North Africa. And therefore, Erwin Rommel, the man who later was opposing the British at the Atlantic Wall, he was called on to go in, the man who had advanced the fastest and done the most spectacular victories in the victory in the West. He was sent to North Africa. By the way, see that road? Remember when I saw films like, A Raid on Tobruk and so on, and they'd be driving down the roads with the white dotted lines done in. My dad said, There never were dotted lines down the roads back then, which is, you know, something you wouldn't necessarily have picked up. The Africa Corps was a small panzer division, but they, although Erwin Rommel was told to just hold his position, protect, he never obeyed orders. He just went ahead and he saw the opportunity and he rushed in and he managed to beat the British again and again. And the Secret War points out that the British continually complained that the decrypts, the Enigma code decrypts, intercepts given by GCHQ were always inadequate. Said, you've always underestimated the strength of the Germans or what their plans are. And the conclusion of Secret War, Max Hastings concludes, no, their intercepts are always accurate and the strengths were always accurate. The point just is that one German division was worth three or four Allied divisions. So they just fought better, fought harder. And the other thing he said that completely confounded the British in North Africa is they'd get the decrypts often over breakfast. Ah, you know, Rommel's been ordered to hold or withdraw something. And they would sort of expect that to happen, but Rommel wouldn't obey orders. He would see an opportunity and he'd launch an attack. And the British were thinking, well, there is no attack planned because they've seen the orders from Berlin. And next thing they're getting overrun. As they said, this is part of the problem that decrypts only go so far as the commanders obey the orders. And when you had a commander as resourceful as the Desert Fox, he would frequently go against orders. Now, this is all relevant to D-Day because he was the key man running the German defenses for Normandy. And if he had been there that day, things would have been different because he had a different philosophy of operation. I'll explain that later. But Rommel's men did amazing things. They built railways in the desert. Now, about this time, the British went into Greece. They sent an British expeditionary force to Greece. Germany knew they had to intervene because the Italian army was getting mauled by the Greeks because they had tried to invade Greece and they'd lost totally everything all the time. Massive humiliations at the hands of the Greek army. In came the British. Now, the German high command knew the most important element that they had in the Balkans was Romania was an ally providing them with oil. The only source of petroleum came from Romania, the Ploesti oil fields. And so with the British and Greece, the danger was they'd move on Romania and threaten Germany's oil supply. They couldn't start Barbarossa if their oil supply wasn't protected. And so quickly the German army had to take the Balkans and they took Yugoslavia all the way down to the to Greece, to Athens, and that was just one of those sideshows that came about. And so while the British were getting pulverized in Greece and fleeing, many of them went to Crete, and this is when Germans were ordered to do an attack on Crete, and this was the largest airborne assault to that date, 1941. And they came in, and they did a spectacular job, but they were not coming in against Crete forces are coming against British forces on Crete. And so they suffered tremendous losses, but they did win. They did prevail. But the German airborne element was effectively crippled. They never, basically, it wasn't as bad as what happened to the British at Arnhem in 1944 at the Bridge too far, but it was pretty bad. So here we get to 6th of June, sixth day of the sixth month, 1944. In preparation for this, the British did a tentative, what do you call it, test run, not a dry run, Dieppe. Dieppe was a port in France. And so they sent the Canadians in to test them, and they wanted to test the German defenses in depth. And it was actually a colossal, catastrophic disaster. And the Canadians lost thousands of men killed and captured, and they didn't achieve their objectives. But the British learned many important lessons from this, and many Canadians to this day are deeply resentful of Britain using them as cannon fodder, just like the Australians and New Zealanders. Regard Gallipoli, 1915, another Churchill special, as using them as cannon fodder for an absolutely unwinnable war. Still, the lessons learned there shaped D-Day. Many people are talking about the opening of the Second Front. In fact, D-Day was not the opening of the Second Front. Anzio and the invasion of Italy was opening the Second Front. Germany was not fighting a two-front war. Germany was fighting a three-front war. The biggest was the Russian front. But then after North Africa, there was the Italian front. And so this was actually opening the third front, not the second front. And so here you can see the battles coming. They're fighting along this massive eastern front, this Italian front, and now the third front's opened. Although every single film and documentary speaks about the second front, like the Italian front doesn't count. But that was massive. Now you can see, while von Rundstedt was in charge of Army Group West, Rommel had Group B, and he would have been responsible for the first response. Now, Erwin Rommel's philosophy was, we are going to be so outnumbered, the only chance we have of winning this invasion is to beat them on the beaches. And that's why he said, when they land, it'll be the longest day. That's a Rommel quote, because we've got to win on the beach. We cannot wait for them to assemble. There's just too many of them. We don't have numbers on our side. So von Rundstedt wanted to keep his panzer divisions, which was his elite troops, way back from the coast to determine where to take them, you know, whether they are needed at Calais, which are most likely, or wherever else. I mean, for that matter, the British could land at Marseille or, you know, almost anywhere. So he wanted them far back, but would take days for their panzers to reach the coast. Rommel wanted to have smaller groups, but close to the coast at every possible place, so that they could respond within hours, not days. So here comes the whole operation. They called it Piccadilly Circus, where they would all meet in the middle, south of the Isle of Wight, south of Portsmouth and Southampton, which are major British ports. And what they are trying to do is to get these Normandy beaches, which is basically across a 50-mile or 80-kilometer front that they're trying to land. Dieppe is where the Canadians were sacrificed to learn how strong the German coastal defenses were and what worked and what didn't work. In fact, nothing worked. And you can see they've got the different ideas. Like the British are going to take, the British paratroopers must take the bridges, like Pegasus Bridge, behind the beaches, and the US paratroopers would get near Sainte-Marie-Église. These were the main leaders of D-Day. So you've got in the middle Eisenhower. Now, General Dwight D. Eisenhower was, as when he was running for president, somebody asked General Douglas MacArthur, do you think Eisenhower will make good president? And Douglas MacArthur's response was, yes, I think he'll make a fine president. He's the best clerk I ever had. Now, Eisenhower, amazingly, in his huge, long, 40-odd year career in the army, never saw combat, never heard a shot fired in anger. He has never in combat, ever. And why is he in charge when you've got serious combat veterans around, like, well, General Field Marshal Montgomery on the British side, and others who would have been, and General Bradley, who is a real soldier. Why is Eisenhower there? I was told by General Ben Parton, who's on our board, that the war was just a couple of years in, 1942, and Major Eisenhower was at a cocktail party in Washington, D.C., and he is having a conversation with the daughter of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the American president. And she said, stay right here. I've got to talk to Dad. She went into the other room, spoke to Father the president, said, I found just the man to run your war for you in Europe. And within months, he had been catapulted from major to lieutenant general and then four-star general and then pushed out the front and made to coordinate all Allied forces, not just American but British forces, for the Western Front. And there's a book written on him called The Politician. Now, Eisenhower liked to portray himself as the soldier and the general. But as people who've got to know him said, he's a politician first and foremost. He was a politician wearing a uniform. And there's a big difference. You could see those people. So you've also got the commander of all the land forces was Montgomery. The commander-in-chief of all the air forces was Lee Mallory. Lee Mallory would be this man behind here wearing the blue, British Air Force. The commander-in-chief of the Allied Naval Expedition was Admiral Ramsay. That would be this British gentleman with those gold rings around his navy blue outfit. And, of course, Bradley on the far left. So these were the seven men who were the high command made the decision when and where. And it was Eisenhower decided D-Day begins 6th hour of the 6th day of the 6th month. Now, why 666? I mean, why choose that particular day? One thing that's incredibly interesting about the timing is the 6th of the 6th, 1944, was the 50th birthday of Mrs. Rommel. So Erwin Rommel, the head of the German response defense of those beaches, was back at home in Germany for his wife's 50th birthday. And he is the one man who would have defied orders and mobilized his men in response, because when he saw a need, a tactical, he even wrote in his book, Infantry Tactics and Tank Tactics, and I've got those books. He even wrote there, the men at the high command don't know the situation on the ground. The commander on the ground must take initiative when he knows. And he said, you cannot wait for messages to be coded there, deciphered on the other side, recoded and sent back to you to make a decision. You've got to go fast. Lives depend on it. Seconds count. You cannot wait for the high command. And there were many a time that the OKW wanted to court-martial Erwin Rommel for blatantly disobeying orders, and only because he won so many great victories did he escape, because he didn't obey orders. He saw what was good on the ground, which was normally not what the people at HQ are saying, and he would take the initiative. If Erwin Rommel had not been at home for his wife's 50th birthday, D-Day landings could have gone very differently. And Montgomery, my father said that we all knew in the 8th Army that Erwin Rommel cared more about us in the 8th Army than our own generals did. He said, we felt that there was more compassion and understanding for our plight as soldiers and practical care from the enemy commander than from our own commanders. He said, we regarded Montgomery as a propaganda prima donna built up to try and bolster our morale, because they knew that most of us were enamored with not just Rommel's fighting skills, but his chivalry and his kindness to defeated enemies. So here you've got a massive concentration of forces. That, by the way, was the Canadian flag back there. They didn't have the maple leaf and all that back then. And so you've got tremendous forces all concentrating. They're coming from many different places, but they're all going to concentrate here. And you've got the 6th British Airborne coming down, the 82nd and 101st US Airborne coming behind Utah. And the Queen at that stage, this would have been Queen Elizabeth, not the one we know as Queen Elizabeth II, but the mother of Queen Elizabeth, who is also a Queen Elizabeth. Seeing British paratroopers ahead of time, these are Americans who seem to think that acting like Indians and putting on war paint is a good idea. War paint, Mohawks, Last of the Mohicans type of thing. Eisenhower, I don't know what you think, but when I look at this, I just look at, these are soldiers. There's a politician wearing a military uniform. But you can see he's not going with them as such. I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking. But I personally wouldn't feel that inspired by a commander-in-chief dressed like that. He doesn't even have a pistol on his belt. Like Malema. Like? Malema. That sort of thing. So here you've got a man who's obviously a politician dressed in a military outfit. And it's not even a real military outfit. You never saw General Patton without his revolvers. I mean, he is ready for action. This guy had no intention of getting into battle. But, you wonder how many of these poor guys survived. See the Screaming Eagles. That's 101st. The Dakotas DC-3s, boy, we used those up at the border in Southwest Africa many a time as well. We've used them in Angola too. And why they had numbers written on their helmets like this, I don't know, but I suppose it's some kind of control system. I'd have felt a little irritated if somebody tried that with me. And you can see the different kits and equipment these poor characters are carrying. I must say, the M1 Garand, fine weapon. If I had to choose between the M16 and the M1 Garand, I'd choose the Second World War M1 Garand over the silly little plastic M16, bing, 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 that they gave their poor guys to use in Vietnam. He's got the bazooka. I wouldn't want to jump with that. And this is, you know, what's it? Stand up, hook up, shuffle to the door, go on green. And so this is how it was. They they did a whole lot of... The battle started with Glimmer. A whole lot of planes, bombers, and a few ships went towards the coast of Calais as part of the deception operation. And they had on these ships massive speakers that were broadcasting sounds of orders being shouted and clanging of chains and all the sounds of a ship weighing anchor and boats. So they were broadcasting in the pitch dark. This is around midnight. Massive amounts. And they were not just dropping bombs. They were dropping, was it Rupert? Little miniature parachutists. They were like teddy bears, I think, but they looked like parachutists, but they were small. And then as they landed, they would have all kinds of firecracker things going off. So you had the sounds of shooting, and you had sparks looking like muzzle flashes. And so this was to persuade the soldiers looking with the searchlights, paratroopers are being dropped and so on and so forth. No real paratroopers being dropped. That was just a deception operation to try and redirect panzers and to confirm the disinformation operation. You also had a huge amount of, this was patrol area, basically to try and keep any fighter aircraft out. You had the British dropping paratroopers on this side, Americans dropping from the other side, and then you've got all these different groups. I don't know who would want to name the Operation Titanic, but anyway, you've got taxable. There's two things certain in life, death and taxes. Yeah. And so there was a lot of movement from different sides, and many of them would go over the side in order to confuse the defenders as to what their plans were. And so American, British, and of course Canadian. The long strips are for airborne assaults, basically protecting the flanks. And then of course most of the tanks and everything else coming over the shore. Quite complex, the British assault area and the goals. Here you can see the airborne plans and where they are planning to drop. And as von Clausewitz said, no plan survives contact with the enemy. Every single military plan fails to stick to plan because you can't predict what the enemy is going to do or not do. But nevertheless, they had these airborne assaults, and it's just nothing like this has ever been seen before. 23,000 airborne troops dropped. And of course, most were dropped in the dark, pitch dark. And some of these poor chaps ended up drowning in canals and everything else. It's just chaos. They were spread all over the place. Some of the gliders and DC-3s got shot to pieces, and people parachuting out at the wrong place, far from their units. And it was quite a lot of general chaos. So these can't be pictures of the actual airdrop that day because it was at night. They landed in the dark. So this looks like a training exercise, actually, on this occasion. The gliders, many of them landed heavy. Pegasus Bridge, which was one of the most strategic, that's now a serious monument, where a British glider landed something like 80 meters from the bridge, which is about as good as you can get. And they seized the bridge in time and managed to keep it. So you can see the seaborne element and the airborne element trying to work in concert. But behind them was rows and rows and rows and rows of other units and others. So the first ones to hit the beaches, well, they're the ones who are going to take most of the casualties and so on and so forth. But this is this massive operation. Now, when you think of it, you often get the impression, if you watch the films like Band of Brothers and so on, of you know, the invaders are totally outnumbered and it's David against Goliath. In fact, it's completely the other way around. It's the biggest Goliath operation ever going against a few Davids. And they had all kinds of different code names for the actual bombing. And here you can see different ships that were bombing. You had bombarding ships, you had HQ ships, you had flagships. And in the black are the German gun batteries that they're particularly targeting. The British seem to have got their targets. The Americans completely and totally and utterly missed their targets. Except Ponta de Hoc, where they managed to get it, but there weren't any guns there. But the Rangers did get there. They also had massive amounts of rockets that were going to be launched. But the trouble with this rocket launching is, apparently, those all went wrong. Most of the ships destroyed themselves, sunk. The rockets landed anywhere except where they were meant to. The rocket bombardment looked brilliant on the propaganda films, but the people landed there said, I don't think one of these rockets ever hits any target whatsoever, except maybe itself. And several of these ships actually sunk while they were launching the rockets. It started fires and the whole ship sunk, and some of these ships blew up, and total disaster. But then you had the bombardments. These are the Lancasters, the biggest. They could drop 14 tons of bombs. Then you had all the different American ones, like the Strata fortresses and then the B-17 flying fortresses. And they were just unloading hundreds of thousands of tons of bombs on France. Now, it may surprise one to know that on D-Day, that day, just that one day, the Allies had 14,000 casualties. The Germans had 1,000 casualties. The French civilians had 30,000. And when you speak about liberation and D-Day and freeing France, well, more French people died in the D-Day bombardment than died from all German hostile actions in the entire 4 years of the German occupation of France. The Allies killed 70,000 Frenchmen from aerial bombardments, but 30,000 just in the D-Day landings. And so, you know, just bear in mind, those are families down there. These are French towns liberated. And you kind of get the impression of these guys coming over and flattening everything. But this is what the propaganda post was. British fighters sweep hourly across occupied France, cheered by French peasants. Now, why do you need a artwork for this? Well, my daughter will tell you that when advertisers ask for artwork, it's because a photograph would reveal how flawed the product is. So, you know, French peasants cheering the fighters flying overhead. Well, there were some fighters flying overhead, but they were shooting rockets into any train or vehicle on the road that moved. And so this is what the beaches looked like. I mean, this is the Allies' pictures. Any poor French soul living anywhere near the coast was either getting the home flattened or themselves incinerated. Just think what devastation that represents. You've got 14, 15, and 16-inch cannons from battleships plastering it. And then you've got bombers like Lancasters coming over and just... This is Le Havre. This is a French town liberated at D-Day. I'd say that's pretty total liberation. These are the pictures they don't generally want to show you. In fact, if you watch The Longest Day, you don't get this impression at all. Even when a Frenchman's home's being bombed, he's waving the French flag out and saying, oh, vive la France. I don't think a person would be that excited while his home's getting bombed. But this is what the town looked like. This is some of the British troops with their Sten guns, an American looking at a apparently church bombed by the size of that bell. And, yep, liberation of France. And the French lost more. This is Ponte de Hoc. So the French lost more people in the Allied bombardments than they did by all German hostile actions, including the battle for France when Rommel and co. were zooming across the countryside with their panzers. So here you can see what the Germans had to respond with. Now, there was 21st Panzer and 12 SS Panzer. Now, Rommel wouldn't have had the say-so over the SS Panzer. That was under Adolf Hitler's personal control.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Was Rommel part of the SS?
No. Here's Wehrmacht. He never joined the National Socialist Party. He wasn't political. Not at all. But 21 Panzer was under his command. If he was there, he would have ordered 21 Panzer into the beach, and that would have made a big, big, big difference. Because the soldiers on the beach were not first line, not second line, not third line soldiers. They were the fourth rate. They were the sick, the lame, the aged. They were Eastern troops. The Americans have this impression that at Omaha Beach they were facing German soldiers. There weren't German soldiers in Omaha Beach. There were Czech, Russian, and Ukrainian soldiers, what they call the Eastern forces. The best German soldiers were all out at the Eastern Front. A few were in some panzer groups waiting to respond. But the men at the beaches in those concrete dugouts and trenches, they were the ones who weren't fit for normal duty. You wouldn't waste your best troops on a static defensive position. And so they had a lot of Russians. And now, if you've watched Saving Private Ryan, there's masses of inaccuracies in it, masses and masses. Just including, if you look at what happens when a bullet hits the water, it's just troop because that water really stops it. But you have these bullets streaking through without any change in direction or anything like that, and which isn't possible. But aside from that, there's one really honest glimpse in Saving Private Ryan. After they take that beach, Dog Beach, and these soldiers in German uniforms come up out unarmed and with their hands up, and the Americans shoot them dead. They came out speaking in Czech. Now, as somebody who's been a missionary to Czechoslovakia, I can recognize Czech language. I've checked with others, and yes, that is Czech. They're speaking. There's no foot subtitles. They don't draw attention to it. But that's one attention to detail, which you've got to say, well, Spielberg got that right. Because the soldiers fighting there, although they were wearing German uniforms, were not Germans. They couldn't waste their German troops on that particular beach. They had Russians, Czech, and Ukrainians. Many of them were Ukrainians. There was a lot of Russians there. So the Americans were actually killing a lot of Russians at prisoners of war trying to surrender. And in this case, Czech soldiers, according to... Interesting how Steven Spielberg puts in regularly throughout the Saving Private Ryan, Americans happily shooting unarmed, surrendering soldiers in German uniforms with their hands up, which I don't know if he's doing it because he's trying to be honest. We did war crimes, or if he thinks it's a good idea. Anyway, it's shocking how much extrajudicial killing took place at the hands of the Americans in the Second World War, and probably since too. But 21 Panzer would have been mobilized if Rommel was there, because he is that kind of commander. He wouldn't have waited. And so, right, you've got, you can see the glider landings, you can see the airborne assaults. The glider landings are when you see the planes coming in. Once you see the parachutes, that's for the parachute landings. And here you can see 12th Panzer and 21st Panzer, they're outside of the operation area. They should have been going in, but they were held back, because even after the first day, Adolf Hitler and Jodl and Keitel and all the rest, and even von Rundstedt, were convinced this is just like Dieppe. It's distraction. The real invasion is going to come at Calais, because all of their intelligence operatives were telling them this, and they were holding back because they were convinced we need to respond to Calais. So they weren't committing their first-line battle-hardened troops to the front. Now, basically, you had something like 140,000 Allied soldiers on the ground, not counting the airmen and navy and so on, plastering them. Facing them was something like 14,000 Germans and Eastern troops combined, and most of them not best quality frontline combat troops, but mostly static kind of guard force type. So, and you can see Rommel in charge of Army Group B. You've got the airborne, you've got the beaches. Now, this is across a 50-mile, 80-kilometer length. And the red areas are what they gained in the first day. And it wasn't continuous. And it was, even at that point, they could have gotten plastered if, for example, 21 Panzer down here by the other side of Cairn had been unleashed. And the men said we were waiting by trucks, crying with frustration that the order wasn't given for us to be unleashed. We just wanted to be able to get at them. And high command was holding them back. Here's the phases. Airborne drop just after midnight to 2 a.m. Second phase, lots of deceit. That's what they did at Calais. And then the aerial attack started at 3 a.m. They start to drop bombs on German defenses in the landing sector. Naval phase, 5 a.m. they start to plaster, and from 6 a.m. they started to actually land. And this shows the expansion, how it grew all the way up to Cherbourg, importance about Cherbourg, a real serious port where ships can dock, and all the way through. And then they were trapped and they couldn't break out. And then they brought in General Patton, who had been suspended from active service for the previous year because he slapped a private for being a malingerer, unwounded but sitting in the medic's tent. These are some of what they called Rommel's asparagus. This just reminds you why you had to land at low tide, because then you could see these things and avoid them. If you land at high tide, you couldn't see, and you would be detonating these things on the way in. So now you see these landing craft, which without which they said they could not have considered the invasion. You had to have a quick landing force. There was something like 36 to 40 people who could fit in one of these. And in Saving Private Ryan, they show these soldiers getting sick on the way in. That's not necessarily nerves. It's because they're all fed such a colossally full breakfast beforehand, and the waves were much higher than they expected, and many of them were just getting seasick. And you can imagine you're coming in, the smoke all around. This is daytime, but it's the smoke of the bombing, the bombardments. And some of that beach looks really, really far. Now, of course, high tide means you could get further in, but high tide means that you're going to be detonating these, which is part of what Rommel's plan was, force him to land at low tide, because at high tide, which would make them closer to the defenses, we make it too hard for them to come in at high tide, basically. That's a reality of the beaches. And these must be men landing long after the shooting's over, or they wouldn't be looking so casual. This is one of the biggest disasters of D-Day. This is called the DD tank. This is a 32-ton tank, which they made into a amphibious vehicle by attaching some propellers to the back. But what good's that going to do? How are you going to keep a 36-ton vehicle up as a vessel? Solution? They built a kind of inflatable boat thing around it. And so they were meant to ride off the vessels, land on the beaches, and you'd have tanks on the beaches, and they would just be able to dominate the landscape because you've got armored vehicles, tanks on the beaches. How easy is that? And you know, it worked very well in ponds back in England demonstrating this, and look how well this works. This is just great. Trouble is, you don't have massive sea waves on the ponds, and so almost every one of them sank to the bottom, and they weren't on the beaches. That didn't help. More successful was the duck. And these duck amphibious type of vehicles, which you saw so nicely demonstrated in the last Indiana Jones film and Crystal Skulls. And these ducks, they actually did the job, and they were quite effective. Notice how they laid out these sort of stretched bamboos and things so you wouldn't just make a quagmire across the beaches. A lot of thought went into this, not just a lot of thought, ingenuity, inventiveness. But still, things go wrong, ships get sunk, ships blow up, and a lot of people are just getting to the beaches by the skin of their teeth, having lost all their equipment and everything else in the drink. So this was a tough, rough operation, not equal. Some of these people are smiling coming ashore. It's not equal. Some beaches, there was no opposition. Other beaches, there was entrenched opposition. You're talking about over 120,000 soldiers landing in one day on beaches 50 miles wide. And, yep, some of the scrap metal, these were put to make it hard for vehicles to get across. And destruction. Here you can see the whole Allied command structure and the difference from British anachronistic Canadian flag all the way through to American flags, and from Pont de Hoc all the way through to the Rangers taking this Pont de Hoc, which was meant to have the worst guns around, but they weren't there. And if you've seen things like Band of Brothers, they were landing here behind Utah. You had some of these major textbook operations of how to take gun emplacements and so on. So nothing goes according to plan. And there were times that this looked like the whole thing's going to fail. It was actually a massive operation which actually could have failed. It really could have failed. There was a whole lot of things that could have gone wrong. And one of the most significant from the Allied perspective, they said afterwards, was that was Erwin Rommel's wife's 50th birthday. made the difference. But just the amount, you may wonder what these balloons are doing, makes it hard for fighters to strafe because there's all these cables that they would crash into if they tried to come through. So that's just meant to be a standard way to make it hard for fighters to strafe. But with a massive Allied air superiority, there was no chance that the German Luftwaffe, which was 95% over the Eastern Front, what did they have to spare on the Western Front? And yet they did make some strafing moves. So the Normandy beachhead landings, you've got here 82nd Airborne on the left flank and 6th Airborne Division on the right near Caen. You had the Scottish coming ashore with the bagpipes. This looks like British. In fact, those helmets are matched on a sort of Henry VIII style Middle Ages helmets. They said that they made a study that 5,000 British soldiers died in the First World War simply because they didn't want, for national pride, to change a helmet to the German design, which Americans have, on health has done, which covers most of your head and your ears all the way to the back and your neck. The British helmets, as my dad said, didn't cover much at all. They knew that the Germans had better helmets and better equipment, and Americans copied it later. But those helmets, just honestly, you look at it and you think the equipment of these men, not adequate, not comparable. What a major, massive operation. And yet, if the Germans had been able to get their panzers there, if they'd had more air force, if I was brought up being taught, we, the English, beat the Germans in the Second World War. But the facts of history is the German military death toll, only 4% was lost to the British. And 5% the Americans, 9% the Western Front. 90% the German losses was in the Eastern Front, fighting the Russians. 1% in the Italian and Baltic, Greek and so on theaters. So the Second World War was primarily not a war between Germany and Britain, France or America. So primarily a battle between communism and nationalism, Soviet Union and Europe. And here you can see one interesting thing. For extra security to make it harder for their planes to shoot down their own planes, they painted all Allied invasion aircraft and gliders with these extra white strips, only for that operation specifically, to avoid friendly fire. They thought people would be really, really nervous. And here again you can see the invasion is on, massive. And you can also see in this Soviet armies massing for the joint blow. Why? Because the second front, what I call a third front, was pleaded for and requested by Joseph Stalin. Joseph Stalin had said, we're facing the brunt of the German army, we need you to distract. And that's why the Allies had been endlessly bombing, distracting, doing everything they can, attacking at the air, attacking at Anzio, Italian front being opened up, in order to take pressure off the Soviet armies. If it was a man-for-man battle between the Soviet Union and Germany, Germany would have won in the first few months. And we'll prove that in a moment. They needed the Allies to be... It's basically, if you're in a ring fighting a man much, much, much bigger than you, and a couple of others climb into the back of the ring to attack you as well, it's that sort of thing. It wasn't an even fight. And yet so often you had in the movies this sort of idea that the Germans were bigger, more, outnumbered us, and we beat them. Exactly the opposite way around. Incredible floating harbors, what they did and what they set up there in order to bring in this massive amount of weaponry. It was a colossal effort. But you can see other interesting things. Now, this is according to their numbers. And you can see sometimes the numbers aren't lining up. Like here, they talk about 11,500 aircraft. You see, others spoke about 10,500. Maybe it's how they are estimated. 107 aircraft lost, and so on. They flew 14,000 flight missions in that one day, and so on. When they say 4,000, 9,000 German deaths, that's actually proven to be inaccurate. There was 1,000 German deaths that day. And maybe what they're doing is adding up civilians or East Europeans or whatever. But speaking about the US suffered most of the casualties, 6,600 versus 2,700 UK, less than 1,000 Canadian. So the Americans definitely took the brunt. And when you look at where most of the deaths were per nation, the big cross is 1 million. The smaller cross is 100,000. Here's, and the little one is 10,000. So speaking about where the death tolls were, and the black crosses are soldiers and the gray is civilians. And you can just see how many civilians, millions of civilians killed. 2 million civilians killed in Germany, 3 million German soldiers killed in the war, and on the Russian side, something around the 20 or more million. And most of the French deaths, the 200,000 they're talking about there, were actually by Allied bombings. Some of the scrap that you can see near D-Day, and some of the chaos that they caused at the beaches with the logistical challenges. There's the Churchill flamethrower and Matilda tanks marching through a French town that wasn't bombed to pieces. And this is how the books can depict it. If you've seen a film like Fury, you get the impression that the Allies were the best at everything. But Michael Whitman is the one who is the greatest tank ace at all time. One of his finest hours was actually just after D-Day. He was in the Waffen-SS from age 22. By January 1944, he had destroyed 88 enemy tanks, almost all on the Eastern Front against the Russians. He was involved in the Battle of Kursk, even the biggest tank battle in history. In April 1944, his Tiger Company was transferred to the Western Front. Following the Allied invasion of Normandy, he was ordered to move up to Normandy, which took him 5 days because Tiger tanks can't drive that fast. This is a 55-ton tank. By this time, a 12-kilometer gap had opened up in German lines under relentless Allied bombardment. Anticipating its importance, the British were reassigned to the high ground near Villers-Bocage, and Wittmann positioned his company near this town. The British 7th Armored Division was ordered to exploit the gap in the German lines and capture Villers-Bocage. Wittmann, at this stage, only had 5 tanks, of which 2 were damaged. So he had 3 good tanks, 2 damaged tanks. As Wittmann's Tiger emerged from cover, it engaged the rearmost British tanks on the ridge and destroyed them. Wittmann then moved his Tiger towards Villers-Bocage, destroying several transport vehicles, then engaged a number of light tanks, followed by several medium tanks. Under continuous fire, Wittmann destroyed another British tank, a self-propelled gun, a scout car, and a half-track. He then duelled a Sherman Firefly. In less than 15 minutes, Wittmann's Tiger tank had destroyed 14 Allied tanks, 2 anti-tank guns, and 15 transport vehicles. And that's the reality versus the myths that you get in fiction films like Fury, where apparently American Shermans can take on German Tigers and win. But in fact, that isn't what really happened. There was a lot of people died there. One of the most interesting books that I've read on all this is Peter Padfield's book, Hess, Hitler, and Churchill, The Real Turning Point in the Second World War, A Secret History. Now, the reason why Peter Padfield calls this The Real Turning Point is everything I've described wasn't necessary. People like my dad were being told, we're fighting to protect the British Empire, we're fighting to protect Britain from invasion, we're fighting to protect Western civilization, Christian civilization, we're fighting for freedom. But in fact, the liberation of France, Belgium, Holland, all of that could have been achieved in 1941 without any loss of Allied life. Rudolf Hess was the very principled deputy Führer. He was known as something of a bit of a pacifist, amazingly. He was a very kind man that he had fought in the First World War, been wounded multiple times, fought at Ypres. He ended the war as a pilot, but he didn't see action as a pilot. He'd seen action as an infantryman, but he had completed his training as a fighter pilot just when the war ended. He had won the coveted Iron Cross for bravery. He was a principled man. Rudolf Hess was born in British Africa, in Alexandria. His father's a businessman. He was educated in English. He was fluent in English. He was, in fact, described as an Anglophile. He was very pro English. Rudolf Hess, the number two, the deputy Führer in the Third Reich, was the man people came to if there was injustice. And he saw that justice was done. He was all the time fighting against Himmler and Goering and Goebbels and others. And many people didn't like him because of the fact that of the hierarchy, because he was a principled man who's always concerned for justice and right and protecting people. For example, during Kristallnacht, when after a Jewish terrorist had murdered a German diplomat in Paris and people went on a rampage in Germany, organized in many cases by Goebbels and mobilizing his people to go and burn down synagogues and smash Jewish business windows and so on. It was Hess who ordered the army out to protect Jewish businesses and synagogues, saying there's an outrage and you can't do this. So although he wore the swastika, he was a man that you could not, even at the Nuremberg trials, they couldn't pin any crime on him. This man had never done anything wrong. He was a very honorable, decent man. Well, in 1941, he started to plan, in fact, he started in 1940. He had already initiated many peace initiatives to England. He had many English friends, and one of his friends and correspondents was the Duke of Hamilton, who was part of the peace group in Britain that didn't want war. Now, you may not have known, but do you know that 5,000 British leaders were detained without trial, locked up by Winston Churchill under security legislation he brought in 1940. This included members of Parliament, members of the House of Lords, lords, admirals, generals, members of the royal family, locked up for the duration of the war without trial because they opposed the war or because they wanted peace or something like this. And Rudolf Hess knew some of them. And so he determined to fly to Scotland, land by parachute in the grounds of the Duke of Hamilton near his castle, and as the deputy Führer, as the second highest in the Third Reich, present these peace offers. We don't need to be at war. It is tragic that Germans and English people are killing one another. And when he was asked why he flew there, he said, "I could only foresee tragedy for Europe if our two great nations continue to fight one another. I just see fields and warehouses full of the coffins of our children and our parents, unless we stop this ruinous war." In fact, Rudolf Hess should have gotten the Nobel Peace Prize. He probably earned it more than any other single individual in the 20th century. He flew in a Messerschmitt alone, a Messerschmitt 110, which was meant to be for two or three people. And he had it specially modified. He flew alone at 47 years old, did his first parachute jump in his life. He'd never jumped up, and he jumped out of the parachute at night. And that is a hard thing to do, a night parachute jump. So Hess's aircraft landed here, crashed here. He landed there, and he was taken to Busby. And here's his aircraft, the Messerschmitt 110. He knew he had to fly at night because he'd be intercepted by day. Within an hour of landing, he was speaking to the Duke of Hamilton. So he actually succeeded in his mission. He had a letter, which he gave to him, addressed on Reich's Chancery letterhead, with peace proposals to be handed to King George the VI of England. So here's some of the fuselages of Hess's Messerschmitt, specially modified, extra-long fuel tanks, no ammunition, didn't carry a weapon, didn't carry his normal dagger or his pistol. He went completely as a emissary of peace, a parlementaire, to parley, to talk peace. He should have been treated as an ambassador, an emissary of peace. He shouldn't have been imprisoned, let alone he is locked up for the rest of his life, then finally murdered when the Russians were talking about closing Spandau prison and releasing him during the Glasnost of 1987. Then he was strangled, and it was proved that he was killed. In fact, they said here that he died of asphyxia due to suspension, but if you are hung, it would, the wire or rope would form a V. If you're strangled, it's horizontal. The autopsy said he was strangled. They handed his body over to this is 1987. He was the last surviving leader of the Third Reich, and he died in 1987 in Spandau prison. He had never been allowed to speak to a journalist or a historian. Just imagine how much information he had. And his family wasn't allowed to talk about the war when they visited him. He didn't see his son for over 20 years. And the Allies treated him, and he is in solitary confinement for most of his imprisonment. He's the last prisoner of the held in the Tower of London. So Churchill kept him under the strictest of regulations, not allowed to talk to anyone, so on. And he was flying to the Duke of Hamilton, offering peace. Now, this was just a couple of days before Operation Barbarossa. So Operation Barbarossa is going to unleash German and Allied, meaning German allies, forces against the Soviet Union. So all of this, D-Day was not needed. Because what was he offering? He was offering them all of France, Belgium, Netherlands, Norway, we'll hand back. We'll withdraw to pre-1940 boundaries. All we want from you is stop the bombing of Germany, end the blockade, sign peace. We will withdraw from everywhere in the West. Just give us a free hand in the East. In fact, Germany had offered this many a time before. But this time, what he is adding is, we won't even require our colonies in Africa back. Because earlier, Hitler's request for peace was, we'll withdraw from everywhere in the West. All we want is, give us our African colonies, Southwest Africa, Tanzania, and so on back. And we want nothing from you. No reparations, no paying back damage. So just think, all those soldiers who died in Normandy and the battle for France and Belgium and Netherlands and all the people who died in the bombing from 1940 on onwards didn't need to die. Because everything the Allies achieved, the liberation of France, Belgium, Netherlands, Denmark, Norway, they could have achieved just by accepting the peace offers of 1940, even before May 1940 war started, even before, because at no 16 different peace offers. And what greater offer could have been made than for the deputy Führer, Rudolf Hess, to fly personally, unarmed, to Britain and to offer this, and with a personal letter for the King of England. We don't believe the King of England ever got that letter. We know that he did not approve of Churchill or his government or of this war, and many of the royal family and leaders in Britain, many of the high command didn't want it. And they were amongst the 5,000 locked up without trial during the during the whole time of the war. So there's been a lot of books over the years written about Rudolf Hess. But this book that's come out, Hess, Hitler and Churchill, The Real Turning Point of the Second World War, is, I think, the most complete, because this has got all the details of his murder. It's got things that have come out from British intelligence that were sealed for the last 60 years. And there is no doubt that Rudolf Hess's flight, if it had been totally successful and that the British had accepted it, no more British people needed to die, or South Africans, Rhodesians, Canadians, New Zealanders, or Australians after May 1940, 1941. Just imagine all that colossal effort I've just been talking about of D-Day wasn't actually necessary, unless you think of it from a Soviet point of view. Because everything in the West, Germany didn't want. They only had to do that to protect themselves, because they knew they were going to be attacked by the Soviet Union, and they couldn't handle a two-front war, let alone a three-front war. The real battle was on the Eastern Front. And, of course, down Italy, that was also a problem. But if they could have made peace with the West, all of that could have been freed without any more loss of life. So all these people buried at Normandy, colossal amount, talking about thousands, on both sides, wasn't necessary if they had accepted Hess's offer and Hitler's offer and the 16 different peace offers made through the Red Cross, Switzerland, Sweden, and others they were trying to communicate through. Interesting that D-Day, the name of the operation was Operation Overlord. Now, who's the Overlord? I've had people suggesting that the Overlord is Satan, and that this was done to save Satan's kingdom in the Soviet Union. This is the position of President Herbert Hoover, the 31st President of the United States of America. Herbert Hoover's book, Secret War, Freedom Betrayed, has a phenomenal amount of evidence on this. capitalism basically saved communism from collapse. The biggest invasion in history was actually Operation Barbarossa. But we're talking about amphibious operation was D-Day. The Germans, with 500,000 of those men, were volunteers from France, Belgium, Norway, even from neutral countries like Sweden, Switzerland, and Spain. There were even South African volunteers. Not many, but there were some. There were even a few British. There were a few American, too, in Operation Barbarossa. And the 4 million men, 3,500 armored vehicles, and 4,000 aircraft was the largest military operation ever launched to that date. It included a lot of Vikings, what they called the Viking Battalion, which was Norwegians. It included Danish. It included Belgians. At the beginning of Barbarossa, 22nd of June 1941, Germany faced a Soviet army, the Red Army, of 5.7 million. 316 divisions. That's more than double the amount of divisions Germany had. They had 117,000 artillery pieces, 25,000 tanks, 18,000 combat aircraft. Much more than Germany was aware of. The German army at this time only had 5,200 tanks, of which only 3,350 were committed to Eastern Front. The Soviets had a 7-to-1 advantage in armor. The Luftwaffe had only 4,000 aircraft to oppose the 18,700 Soviet aircraft. They fought over 2,900-kilometer front. On D-Day, we're talking about a 50-mile front or an 80-kilometer front. This is a 2,900-kilometer front. 600,000 motor vehicles, 750,000 horses. Just for the German army and the European volunteers to liberate Russia from communism and the Soviet threat. In the first day, 1/4 of the total Soviet Union Air Force was destroyed. The blitzkrieg tactics devastated the Red Army, made stupendous progress, even though the Soviet army was at full readiness, knowing this was coming, and were preparing their own invasion, and they were in the forward areas.
Just to compare the two fronts, D-Day, 80 kilometers about Durban to Maritzburg, and then Eastern Front is about Cape Town to Pass Pretoria.
No, it's Cape Town to Lusaka. It's 1,600 kilometers to 1,500 kilometers to Pretoria, 3,000 k's to Lusaka. But yeah, I mean that's the logistical complications, and the Russian infrastructure was so primitive that dirt roads turned to mud, and to supply frontline troops became an almost impossible task. But by the end of 1941, Germany had captured more than 500,000 square miles of Soviet Union's richest territory, including 75 million inhabitants, a third of their pre-invasion population, 30% the productive capacity, and they were welcomed. And at the top of that, by the end of the year, the Soviet Union had lost more than 3 million of the army. About half the army had been either killed or captured or surrendered, along with 20,000 Russian tanks destroyed, 18,000 military aircraft, that's almost the entire Russian Air Force destroyed. More than 60,000 artillery pieces either destroyed or captured. What no one could have anticipated was the vast amount of aid which the United States of America would give the Soviet Union, Lend-Lease. Even before America entered World War II officially, they were shipping vast quantities of military hardware shipped and trucked into Russia via Alaska or going up through Iran or going by the Murmansk into Russia. On the 24th of June 1941, 6 months before Pearl Harbor attack, President Roosevelt held a press conference announcing America would give all possible help to Stalin's Soviet Union. This was not well received in America. An opinion poll conducted in July found 54% of American respondents were opposed to aiding the Soviet Union. But Roosevelt persisted, what he called the arsenal for democracy, to ship vast quantities of military aid to the most vicious anti-Christian dictatorship on the planet. On the 10th of May 1940, Britain invaded neutral Iceland to provide a better base for supplying the Soviet Union with advanced weapons of war. Neutral Iceland. They then handed that over to Americans later on in the war to aid the Murmansk fleets. Now, the main routes that they went Arctic convoys to Murmansk. That was the most dangerous. Only about 10% of the aid went that way. 50% went by ship via the Pacific and also up through Persia. So in 1941, Allies then opened a corridor through Iran to Russia. This was made possible by completing the 1939 Trans-Iranian Railroad, which linked the Persian Gulf with all points of Iran. The British and Soviets then engaged in joint operations to invade and overthrow the Shah of Iran, Reza Pahlavi, and to seize control of Iran and its neutral, its strategic railroad. Allied forces sweep on Iran. And this is it's a neutral country. They just invaded them because they needed it in order to supply the Soviet Union. And so Allied convoys from America could sail around the Cape of Good Hope, unload the cargoes at ports in Iraq and Iran, and that led to 25% of the total supplies going into the Soviet Union, much more than what went through Murmansk. Also, the Alaska-Siberian aircraft route, you can see the Russian flag and the that looks like the European Union flag back there. And they were shipping in aid directly to the Soviet Union. Major Jordan was one of the people in American Air Force responsible for these convoys, and he documented this because he thought this is treason, and this was published later. The arsenal of democracy, the people building these couldn't have possibly imagined that most of the weapons they were building were going to go to a dictatorship that had the blood of tens of millions of Christians on their hands. The arsenal of democracy, they called it. Here's an official list of the military hardware supplied by the United States to the Soviet Union from 1941. And this dwarfs what I've just spoken about in D-Day. 13,713 tanks and armored vehicles. That's a lot of tanks for the Red Army. Good tanks, too, in many cases. All going to the Soviet Union. Here they are, in the Soviet Union. Even the T-34 was an American designed by Christie. He built the Christie tank. An American Department of Defense handed over the plans of the most advanced tank of the Second World War, they said, to the Soviet Union Red Army. And there it is, built with American weapons. And this is the British Crusader tank. This is the Grant and Lee tank, which is American, but it's in Soviet Army. You don't normally see pictures of British and American tanks in Red Army because you're not meant to know about that. You've got to ignore these facts. On the Eastern Front, a British Matilda tank, which had the thickest armor. All these tanks shipped to the Soviet Union. 14,795 military aircraft. Some of the best aircraft the Allies had, they shipped off to the Red Army in the Soviet Union, including fighters, bombers, reconnaissance aircraft. Here's the Red Army in front of, yep, that is definitely an American Liberator, so-called. These are Western planes with Red Army red stars on them. US C-47 Skytrain, 77,972 Jeeps, 375,883 trucks, General Motors and Ford trucks going to the Soviet Union Red Army. How could the German army have known that everything they'd been destroying of the Russian army would be replenished by the free Western capitalist democracies? 35,170 motorcycles, 8,071 tractors, 15,631 artillery pieces, over 131,000 machine guns, 1,981 locomotives, 90 cargo ships, 4.5 million tons of food supplies, $1 billion of machines and equipment, and we're talking about 1940s money, 2,670,000 tons of petroleum products, 49,000 tons of leather, 3,700,000 tires, 15.5 million pairs of army boots, 106,000 tons of cotton, building equipment estimated at $10 billion. Non-iron metals, 802,000 tons. They called it Russia's lifesaver. Lend-lease. And by the way, there was no lend-lease. This is free. The British had to pay for what they got. The Russians got it free. Well, not that free. South Africa paid for it. It was South African gold that Smuts shipped by the USS Quincy after doing his coup d'etat, replacing South Africa's most popular prime minister ever, General James Barry Hertzog, who refused to declare war on Germany in 1939. So Jan Smuts had just lost 5 elections over the previous years to General James Barry Herzog just seized power, no referendum, no free elections, and this is how the democracies were run. Nobody elected Churchill in 1940. Nobody elected Stalin. Nobody elected Jan Smuts. And yet they were running the democracies and using South African gold to pay America for Lend-Lease to give all this free to Russia. And the South Africans weren't even asked. 29 tankers, 433 combat ships. The U.S. also brought 2 million tons of petroleum products, mobile bridges, railway equipment, aircraft radio equipment, many other items. 470,000 tons of explosives. Vast amounts of small arms. 1.4 billion rounds of small arms ammunition. 21 million rounds of ammunition of 37 millimeter and larger. Raw materials delivered were enough for the Soviets to load more than 60 million artillery shells. The U.S. sent 270,000 tons of rolled steel, enough to manufacture 15,000 T-34 tanks, which was an American design anyway. And all of this U.S. effort resulted in an immense quantity of war material delivered to the Soviet Union. Weapons, support systems, raw materials. In terms of major weapon systems, the U.S. delivered 11,400 aircraft, 7,000 tanks, 5,540 millimeter anti-aircraft guns, 1,000 quad-mounted 50 caliber anti-aircraft guns, 2,581 millimeter mortars, 137,045 caliber submachine guns. Imagine if the German army had had that for Operation Barbarossa to fight the Soviets. No Americans need to die during the Cold War if they could have killed the Soviet Union at that time in 1941. The Americans provided such a vast amount, you can't believe it. Over 100 million yards of cotton cloth, 62 million yards of woolen cloth. It just carries on, right down to 50,000 hair clippers and 257 million buttons. And that's just the Americans. The British and the Canadians gave even more. Great Britain sent over 5,218 tanks, 5,500 Boffers anti-aircraft guns, 12 minesweepers, 5,800 aircraft. I mean, I thought Britain was short of aircraft. They sent 3,300 Hurricane, 1,000 Spitfire fighter aircraft to Russia. These are the best fighter aircraft in the world. $1.7 billion worth of supplies to Stalin and Soviet Union, while we in South Africa and Rhodesia were sacrificing and under rations to provide for the poor British who were running out of food and supplies and so on. Meanwhile, they're running out of food and supplies because they're shipping it to the Soviet Union. Canada supplied the Soviet Union with 2,788 tanks and armored vehicles, 1 million artillery shells, and 208,000 tons of wheat and flour. There is no doubt that without the Western aid, the Soviet Union wouldn't have been able to survive the year, which would have been a good thing. Would have saved us the whole Cold War and how much suffering through the rest of the world. Russian historian Boris Sokolov wrote in 1998, Lend-Lease was the decisive factor in the Soviet ability to continue the war. In fact, the British went beyond this. They even sent RAF personnel, Hurricanes, to help the Russians defend the Murmansk line for the supplies. And they even flew missions over Murmansk. And in fact, their commander was awarded the Order of Lenin by the Soviet ambassador. There's so much on the Murmansk convoys risking the lives of the Royal Navy in order to take weapons up to the Soviet Union. The colossal American military aid shipped to Stalin Soviet Union was neither morally defensible nor wise. The money, in just their money, just colossal. Billions, hundreds of billions. Capitalist America, Britain and Canada, helped salvage the Soviet dictatorship in Russia from collapse, helped fund, fuel, and arm the greatest military threat to Western civilization in the history of mankind, the Soviet Union. How short-sighted is that? You know, we didn't have to fight Germany. They didn't want to fight us. But we certainly didn't need to help the Soviet Union. If we just sat out the war, the world would be in a better place. Yalta is a swear word in Eastern Europe. And I learned this from ministering from Poland all the way through Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Yugoslavia, to Albania in the south. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord, therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you. The Soviets are never our friend. Black Book of Communism documents that. The arsenal of democracy is a fraud. America becomes the arsenal of democracy. It would have been more honest on a stamp to put, the arsenal of Stalin's Soviet Union Red Army. You might as well have dumped all that aid in the middle of the Atlantic. It would have done more good. And yes, Captain America is one of the propaganda lies produced at that time to try and get people enthusiastic about fighting against Christian civilization, actually, and for communism to conquer most of Europe. Americans will always fight for liberty, I wish, but they were actually fighting for the enemy of liberty in Stalin's Soviet Union. Should you help the wicked and hate, love those who hate the Lord? Herbert Hoover's indictment is even more colossal. I won't even go into that. That's a whole other story. That's a 900-page from America's 31st president. Herbert Hoover is a Nobel Peace Prize-winning man who kept millions of people alive in the First and Second World War and the Finnish War by his humanitarian efforts. A great man. Agenda explains how the communists have taken over every aspect of Western entertainment, education, news media. It's so important that we know the truth so that the truth can set us free and we can recognize the lies of propaganda. Jan Hus said, seek the truth, listen to the truth, teach the truth, love the truth, abide by the truth, and defend the truth unto death. So, any comments, questions? D-Day was amazing, but to think that that's just a fraction of what was given to the Soviet Union.
Planning is scary. I mean, how do you even plan something like that, you know?
Indeed.
Coordinate it, you know?
Crazy. Well, here's a thought. Imagine if the Church of Christ put that kind of energy and focus into fulfilling the Great Commission.
Yeah.
I mean, just imagine, because D-Day was... these are some films which I don't think this was very accurate. These guys tried to make an accurate film. It's just, you know, 1962, but still. They tried to give both sides. In Saving Private Ryan, you don't get a German side, you just get the American side. A Bridge Too Far, I think, is the best film ever made on the Second World War, personally. Not perfect, but it's the best. I don't think they've ever made a more honest, accurate war film on the Second World War. If you haven't seen that in a while, it's in our library. Highly recommend. I mean, just the scene of the para landing and sounding as a horn to get the, the British had this little horn for fox hunting. Mm-hmm. He sounded the horn to rally his troops and wearing his Batman's packing and we put my dinner jacket in there. Are you sure you're going to be needing that, sir? I certainly hope so. But all the different aspects, they really, this film, they really worked on everything in the film. Came from eyewitnesses. I think they only had one fictional character. The man who did the book, both that The Longest Day and The Bridge Too Far is built on, Stephen Ambrose, I think, he actually interviewed the survivors and he got the stories and he put into his book and they put into film only firsthand, what they saw, what they said, what happened. And that's why, you know, a person can look at this film and think, surely not. And yet, even the most incredible things in there actually happened. Like the paratroopers of the 1st Airborne, the British going over to the Germans saying, we've got so many wounded people who've run out of medicines. Could we have a ceasefire so that we could transfer our wounded into your hospitals? And certainly you can have 2 hours. And 2 hours later, they start the war again. But and a lot of people said, you know, that's got to be Hollywood. But actually, that actually happened. That's actual research. The amazing things, mind-boggling things that can happen in war. At least this is one film where they actually try to get it right. The funny thing is they were criticized for fiction when they were actually accurate on those points. So, any other comments or questions?
Just interesting facts about some of the places that the people landed to jump with the parachutes. Some landed in wells, some got tangled up in trees and church towers and so forth.
Shame, yes. If you go to that church in Saint Marie Eglise, they've actually still got, as a monument, they've got a parachutist hanging from the spire. One of them who survived just hanging there, watching everything falling to pieces there. He is stuck on a church fire, unable to get out, just too high to cut himself loose or anything. And so they've actually still got that parachute just in a model form on the church spire as a reminder of that.
Why were they jumping so high there? I believe they were 2,000 foot there or something.
Huh? I don't think they knew how to jump. At that stage, they were all very new at this sort of thing.
It's just a sitting target up there. Yeah? Our battle jumps are 500 foot. It's 200 foot to open the barrage and then
I think that got refined during the Rhodesian War, because I think the Americans and British were all thinking we need room for error, so they wanted to give you more time to think of your drills if you're getting a Roman candle and things like that. Yeah, but I think the Rhodesians broke the record in South Africans with the lowest jumps. Second World War, they weren't daring to drop that low.
A chance of shooting anybody down 500 foot.
No, too quick. On top of them.
They also had those huge lights that could pick out the planes.
Yeah. So
they had those huge lights that for kilometers up in the air.
So it probably was better for the pilot to be higher, but not better for the parachutist.
But it's easier to shoot a plane than a parachute.
But you've heard like in A Bridge Too Far, the chap saying, "We're very short of planes. We can't afford to lose a single plane." And so they were basically jeopardizing the parachutists by, "We're landing you 8.4 kilometers from, no, miles, 8.4 miles from your target." Why? Well, because there's flak here and we can't afford to lose any planes. So, you know, you're expendable, but our planes aren't. You know, that kind of mentality.
You know, if they use the modern method of coming over the treetops, nothing can shoot you down going too quickly and then just climb to 500 foot. Drop your parachutes and get out. You know, that would
I don't think
that's crazy.
I don't think the pilots were that well trained. They'd done mass production, and many of these people were so ill trained. You know, he's the Anglican Church of England minister at Pons back in the 70s and 80s. And my mother was actually a member of his congregation for a while. He was the blind priest. He was in the first wave of D-Day. He got shot and blinded. Before he could even get off the ramp of his landing craft, and end up in hospital ship and all this. And he came to Christ in the hospital, became a priest, studied 7 years without being able to see. And, you know, he'd be reading from Braille. Palace, St. Stephen's Church, just off the square. And, you know, speaking to people like that, I mean, imagine that you do all that training. And he got shot before he even could get on the beach. But the testimonies. We had a neighbor at our first mission office in Claremont. He is in D-Day. He got shot through the hip first day by a machine gun, and he was lying in a ditch for over 28 hours before anyone found him and just trying to stay alive. And he walked with a limp, but... You know, all around us, over times we've been growing up, we've met people who went through all these things. And there was, in Somerset West, a Stuka pilot who, you've got to have nerves of steel to be flying those things down, dropping the bomb. And he only died a few years ago, and he'd survived the war, spent time in British concentration camps and all this, and what stories these people had. You know... It's an amazing generation what these people went through. And now we've got these snowflakes afraid of somebody hurting their safe space and hurting their feelings. But it just shows you what people can be trained to do. But I'd like the dedication that was exercised on D-Day to be shown by the church for reaching the unreached. I mean, just imagine if the church is mobilized, said, "This is a war, spiritual war. Let's get mobilized. Let's really, we can do amazing things if we put our minds to it."
Soldiers for 1 year, to make sure they get it. Who's doing that? Then the diesel, then the. That's just crazy.
And the medics.
It's crazy.
The hospital ships and everything else. Yeah. Just colossal.
They all hit the beaches at the same time. They're all different. It's crazy.
Yes.
It's
really well, of course, many didn't.
Yeah.
Saving Private Ryan, while it wasn't a real event they were talking about, it was classic that we've landed at the wrong beach. Things like this. Where's the tanks? Well, tanks actually at the bottom. But there was all sorts of things that just went wrong. But that's what you've got to expect too. No plan survives contact with the enemy. I think that's just true with Kasinga. Colonel Breton was talking about how the Air Force dropped them miles from where they were meant to be and all sorts of things. And some guys dropped on the wrong side of the river and there's no end of hassles. But yeah. So this is quite an event. 75 years and there's still people who took part in D-Day. And so I think there's some 97-year-old chap who did a parachute jump today. That's quite extraordinary. I mean, credit. I would never want to get anyone to get the impression that I'm being critical of the soldiers. They sacrificed for what they believed was a good cause. But the politicians who sent them there when there was alternatives, people like that, God's got a special place for them.
So was Hitler, did Hitler send his or did he go on his own mission?
$1 million question. There's a lot of arguments for and against. I believe that Hitler knew and approved, but he, like many leaders, had plausible deniability. So if he succeeded, it was my idea all along. If he fails, how could he do this to me? You know, I think it was that kind of thing. I think Rudolf Hess was such a principled man. He wouldn't have done it if he didn't believe that it was what was wanted. In fact, he, just before the flight, he asked, and this is documented in David Irving's Hitler's War and so on, that, and there's many eyewitnesses, Hess questioned Hitler after a major policy speech, do you still adhere to your peace offers to Britain? And he said, yes, certainly they're still valid. And shortly after this, he takes off on his flight and goes. And he had made all these initiatives. In fact, Adolf Hitler had told him, can't you speak to your British friends and try and get them to see reason? Can't we go past Churchill and his war clique and negotiate with the ones who are for peace? And he's pointed out, well, many of them are now detained. They're locked up, included admirals and members of Parliament. But Hess must have gone believing that he had the full support of Hitler. Hitler denied it afterwards, but I think that's typical politician. Something goes wrong. Also, you see, from his perspective, if it succeeded, it would have been a mega coup success. But because he failed, immediately people like Mussolini are saying, you were negotiating a separate peace. So for the sake of his other allies, he'd say, no, Hess did this on his own. I don't believe Hess would have done this without... Why would he risk it unless he believed that the offer was backed and was good? And he actually offered... The only thing he offered different from what had been offered before was we won't even require our colonies back. You can... You know, what was taken at the end of First World War, we'll write that off. So the offer of withdrawing from everywhere in the West to pre-1940 boundaries... That offer had been made in many other times. So Hess wasn't offering anything radically different except dropping the request for the colonies back. It must have been decided this had to be the most... how could you make your offer more plain? You're not just sending some emissary or ambassador. You're sending a deputy. And he's at great risk. It's quite a feat for a 47-year-old man to fly... alone across the North Sea, parachute in the dark, first parachute ever. It's an amazing operation. And that he actually succeeded insofar it was in his power to actually present these and deliver these things. So he should have actually been honored and they should have put him up at Buckingham Palace as an emissary. I mean, why lock him up and treat him like a criminal? Normally you walk across no man's land with a white flag and, they normally treat you decently. To have treated him like a criminal and all that, lock him up for the rest of his life. So Hess, nobody to this day has been able to point out any crime, let alone war crime. Do you know what he was sentenced to life imprisonment for? Crimes against the peace. The one man who nobody could say could have done more to actually work for peace. So, that's... That's pretty pitiful and shameful that Hess was treated like that.
Yeah, because in the stories I read about him, he's portrayed as a guy on his own mission, who's a little bit loony.
That's how the British had to... But I mean, how are you to deal with this? How can you discredit it? There are people out there in the field, like my dad, who think we're doing this for Britain because we have to, because our back's against the wall and we've got no choice and Hitler wants to invade us and take the empire and we're trying to defend the empire. And if he suddenly hears, actually, you know, Dieppe and D-Day and so on, none of this is necessary. We could have got the liberation of France, etc., etc. Peace. All we need to do was stop the naval blockade and stop bombing Germany. I mean, hey, how easy is that? So a lot of people would have said, well, why don't we take it? So the best thing is, this wasn't a serious offer by the deputy, but he's crazy. In fact, both sides said he's crazy. And interestingly enough, there's David Irving's written a whole book on Hess. And on it, he said that Hess tried different things, like he feigned madness and amnesia. But what else could he do? He knew a lot of secrets. They used even truth drugs on him, and he beat them every time. And at one point, when he was asked to make his statement at the trial, Nuremberg, he stood up and clear as anything, rattled off a whole lot of facts and said, it's been the greatest honor of my life to serve the Third Reich. And he said, and I fooled all of you. Thought I'd lost my memory, this and the other and so on. And he basically slapped them in the face. And he didn't back down at all. There was no words of, I'm sorry or whatever, like Albert Speer did. Hess was clever. At one point, he tried to commit suicide after being arrested, captured in Britain. When he realized he had failed, they're trying to interrogate. He actually jumped off a balcony, hoping to kill himself. Didn't work things, though. Because he had information. He is doubtless afraid he could betray his country by betraying secrecy. He knew about Operation Barbarossa, for example. He couldn't have known at that stage the British already knew about it. And the Russians already knew about it. We only know that because the secret war. This book is a book of mine on a photographic collection of D-Day, and it's got, for example, it's quite amazing explaining everything on here, but you know, it's got extraordinary historic documents and pictures, and if anyone wants to look at that, these books are, and it's not but these are kind of pretty precious. They're my only copies of these, but I find it useful. I've always been fascinated by the Second World War, and I do believe it's important for us to understand how we got to be where we are.